KALW. From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
The Mission, Excelsior,
Redwood City,
American Canyon,
San Francisco.
Coming up, we'll hear what President Trump could mean for local transit projects.
The Trump campaign stated that they want to reinvest in America, which, you know, count me in.
But the reality is playing out differently. Then we'll hear a Bay Area comedian's take on her own material.
But, you know, whatever I talk about basically is like a quote-unquote radical because I'm saying it.
And we'll learn the story behind this week's Audiograph mystery sound. That and more today on Cross Currents. The Trump administration has thrown a major hurdle in front of Caltrain. Last week, federal officials held back money that would have helped upgrade the train tracks on the peninsula. This could have big consequences for Caltrain and for dreams of high-speed rail. It's also one of the first clues we have about what President Trump could mean for transportation. Here to talk with me about that is KALW's transportation reporter, Eli Wirtschafter. So let's start with Caltrain and high-speed rail. What happened last week?
Yeah, so just for some background, Caltrain had applied for this almost $650 million grant from the federal government to help pay for electrification, upgrading its tracks, making it a greener system, and also, you know, enabling it to carry more passengers. Right now it's on diesel. And this is important for high-speed rail, too, because they're planning to run on those same tracks, and they need to be electrified. So a couple weeks ago, California Republicans in U.S. Congress wrote a letter to Elaine Chao just a few days before she was confirmed as the new Secretary of Transportation. And this letter basically said, don't give out the grant to Caltrain unless you first do a full audit of California high-speed rail.
Wow.
This grant had been cleared by the Obama administration right before Trump's inauguration, but it couldn't actually be signed and approved for 30 days. So last Friday was the first day they could have signed it.
And so what happened on Friday?
They announced that it was delayed. It's TBD. Federal officials said it would be announced when Trump puts out his whole budget, but that could be weeks away. It could be months away. We're not sure.
Okay, so where does that leave Caltrain?
They now say that if they don't have the funding by next Wednesday, they need to call off their contractors. Costs could start rising. And Seamus Murphy, he's a spokesman for Caltrain, he says that if they don't get the funding at all, then the whole project could be in peril.
It may be that a decision to defer is also a decision to kill the Caltrain electrification project.
Now, Caltrain has started a petition to the White House to get the grant approved. Also, a lot of Silicon Valley business leaders have been pushing to make it happen. And, you know, that seems possible. Even the Republicans who asked for the grant to be delayed say that Caltrain electrification is basically a good project. They just don't want to pay for anything that supports high-speed rail, which they see as really wasteful and poorly managed, not without reason. Transit experts I talked to said they had never seen this before, that a grant that goes this far through the approval process has always been signed in the past.
Okay, so besides this one grant, what other kinds of clues do we have about how the Trump administration is going to handle transportation?
So it's still a big question in a lot of people's minds. In his campaign, this was a huge talking point that he's going to build bridges and roads and also train systems. And it's something he said as president, too. The only details we have are unofficial. There's this document going around showing a list of 50 projects they might choose to prioritize, and it gives us some idea of what they're thinking. There's a lot of energy projects, things like dams and pipelines and wind farms. And there's also bridges and trains in there, actually including high-speed rail for Texas.
But no high-speed rail for California.
Not high-speed rail in California. There's actually only two projects in there for California specifically, and they're both about delivering renewable energy.
And why those kinds of projects?
So the Trump team has emphasized public-private partnerships as a way to do infrastructure. So that's projects where you can get private sector money investing in the project. And so if anyone's investing, there has to be profit in the project somewhere. So this list of projects includes things that make money, things like delivering electricity or selling train tickets or charging bridge tolls. And that was basically Trump's infrastructure plan during the campaign, the idea that the government could make it easier for private companies to invest in infrastructure. They said you could give big tax breaks to companies that invest and get a lot more money into infrastructure without doing tons of government spending. Now, the criticism of this is that it only works for infrastructure projects that charge something to users, like, you know, the electricity. So it's still a question whether the administration wants to directly spend money on, you know, fixing roads.
So President Trump signed an executive order saying that he'll take away funding from sanctuary cities, places like San Francisco and Oakland that don't fully cooperate with federal immigration authorities. Can the Trump administration really cut federal transportation dollars from cities that refuse to cooperate on immigration enforcement?
Right. So the sanctuary cities in question are already saying, no, that's unconstitutional. And here in San Francisco, the city attorney, Dennis Herrera, has filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration over the order. And the kind of funny thing is that he's using some of the same arguments that conservatives used to resist Obamacare a couple years ago.
The Supreme Court, in a case involving the Affordable Care Act, said that the federal government can't put a financial gun to the head of local and state governments. That remains true no matter who is in charge in Washington, D.C.
But if they're able to follow through on defunding cities, what would that mean for our transportation system?
Right. So only 9% of Bay Area transportation money comes from the federal government. That's smaller than most areas because we fund a lot of transportation locally. But still, we're talking about billions of dollars coming from the federal government that would be hard to replace. The easiest portion of that for the Trump administration to target would be big discretionary grants like the Caltrain electrification. Another example of something like that coming up is the BART extension to San Jose. BART is asking for federal funding for that. Now, in the meantime, some BART board members want to declare BART a sanctuary transit agency. So you could imagine if transit funding becomes really politicized, the Trump administration saying, no, we're not supporting that project for a sanctuary transit agency.
That's amazing to hear that, a sanctuary transit agency.
I think it would be the first in the country. But really, most of the people I talk to seem less concerned about specifically the threat to sanctuary cities coming to pass and more just generally worried about what Republican Congress means for transportation dollars. I talked to Scott Wiener. He's a Democratic state senator who's recently a San Francisco supervisor, did a lot of transit stuff while he was here. And here's what he has to say.
Regardless of what Donald Trump says, we know that the right-wing ideologues in Congress, they don't believe in government. They don't believe in government investment. They certainly don't believe in public transportation. So I'm not holding my breath for the federal government to do more. And I hope I'm proven wrong.
But, you know, when it comes to Trump, pretty much everyone has been wrong at some point about something. So we shall see.
We shall see. Okay, thanks so much, Eli. Eli Wertschafter is KALW's transportation reporter. If you have transportation questions you want to get answered, email him at transportation@kalw.org. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Julie Kane, in for Hanat Baba. If you like going to open mic nights in San Francisco, chances are you've seen comedian Irene Tu hosting one. Man-haters, Hysteria, The Mission Position. Those are just some of the shows where you'll find Irene telling jokes and trying to make better, safer spaces for women and queer comics to perform. Irene spoke with KALW's Jen Chien about how she became a comedian and why she thinks her perspective is important. We'll start with a clip of Irene at the Setup Club in San Francisco.
Actually, we're at a very small independent activist bookstore, which means our target clientele are people who don't believe in capitalism. Very good business model. I think our slogan is not thriving, barely surviving. If that's the case, we're killing it. But, you know, I like the customers that we get, you know, the few, they'll come in, they'll be like, oh, I want to get this book on Malcolm X. How much is it? I'm like, it's $15. They're like, I don't believe in money. I'm like, okay. The book is still $15. Don't really care if you don't believe in it. You still have to pay. But usually I feel bad. You know, I want them to have the book. I think it's important, right? So I'm like, all right, let's just go halvesies on it. How about you pay $7? I'll pay the rest of my paycheck. And we'll give you the book. So, what I'm saying is I volunteer at a bookstore.
So, you grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. So, what originally brought you out to San Francisco?
I'm not really sure exactly, like, because I was like 10 and I was like, I want to live in San Francisco. I don't really know what that means. I just knew that there were like gay people in San Francisco because I didn't really know any gay people in where like I lived. And I was like, oh, it's like gay and it's sunny and it's pretty. And my favorite band, Third Eye Blind, lives there. So I was like, I gotta live there.
I love this story.
Yeah, and I've actually never met Third Eye Blind, so I'm like still waiting.
Uh-huh, that's just like the last piece of the puzzle.
Exactly. I never thought I was gonna be a comedian. I was like gonna be a doctor or a scientist or an NBA player, which, you know, can't really happen. It wasn't until this girl that I had a crush on in high school was like, hey, you're funny. And I was like, yeah, maybe I could do comedy. So you can thank her for that.
I'm sure a lot of people have similar stories about right. where the inspiration comes from. I'm just trying to impress her.
Yeah. It was like, I tried to be funny, and I guess I'm a comedian now. So I take most of my stuff from my everyday life, things that I notice, whether they happen to me or to other people. I think that's most interesting to me. Or if there's like a subject that's very taboo.
I want to play another clip from your act. I was really impressed with one of your jokes that went to a pretty dark place, sure. but was still funny and kept the audience with you and actually had kind of a point to it underneath the darkness. So the setup is that you tell the audience you were really into dictators when you learned about them as a kid because they got stuff done. And then more recently, you decided to look up who the worst dictator was.
And the number one dictator of all time with 78 blood drops, which means he killed 78 million people, was Chairman Mao. Yeah. When I learned that, I didn't know whether to feel like mad or proud. Because I was like, oh, he's Chinese. Like, of course he killed the most number of people. Like, we worked the hardest, obviously. That's my boy. But then I felt mad because I was like, wait a minute. Like, Mao doesn't get the credit that he deserves, right? He killed 60 million more people than Hitler. He did a way better job at his job. Why is everyone talking about Hitler? I feel like that's racism. Like, why do white guys get to be the best and the worst?
The point you put on it is, well, that's racism. It's a funny line, but yes. It's also, it sounds like there's a grain of truth in that for you as well, or maybe more than a grain. There's
sure. Yeah, I think that is, I wrote that line because I think it is very true. Like, no matter what it is, like, the white guy will always get the most credit. So, in, you know, people will argue with me and be like, well, Mao didn't kill all those people. A lot of those people died from famine. But I'm like, yeah, but still nobody really talks about him. And a lot of people died.
You are a Chinese American woman. You're a lesbian. You present as a butch person.
Sure, yeah.
Do you feel like a responsibility to talk about those things in your act in almost an educational sense? A lot of stand-up audiences still kind of skew white, skew middle class, perhaps
sure.
skew hetero.
I like to talk about like all of my identities in my stand-up, but I would never like want someone to label me as such. I kind of just talk about it because that's my life, and that's like my point of view and what's most interesting to me. And, you know, I'll talk about other things too, but I mean, it is important to talk about it because, like, no one, like, really, like, most stand up you listen to, it's like some white guy talking about whatever his point of view is. So I think it's important for me to, you know, kind of explain myself, and then you get to see like a different point of view. But, you know, whatever I talk about basically is like a quote unquote radical because I'm saying it.
That was comedian Irene Tu speaking with KALW's Jen Chien. You can catch Irene tonight at the monthly comedy show she co-hosts, Man Haters, at the White Horse. For more details on that, go to KALW.org, click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Julie Kane, in for Hanat Baba. And now, it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. All week long, we've been playing you this sound.
Now, if you could please turn off the sound. Here we go again.
Think you recognize that? To tell you more, we sent KALW's Nina Gensler Debs to Hayes Valley.
This is Gavotte en Rondo from Partita E Major by Johann Sebastian Bach. It's easily one of classical music's greatest hits, a standard. What's not so standard is where and how it's being performed. Violinist Nadia Tishman stands on a platform in the middle of an industrial-looking room, surrounded by people lounging on ottomans holding cocktails. While she plays, an image of the Voyager 1 space probe slowly drifts across three screens mounted above her head. It's an homage to the Golden Record launched back in 1977, featuring, among other things, this very piece. At tonight's performance, we'll travel musically, not only to space, but to Hawaii, pastoral England, Peru, and inside computer circuitry. This kind of musical exploration is normal at Soundbox. Soundbox is the San Francisco Symphony's experimental music space. First launched in 2014, each concert at Soundbox has a theme and is put together by curators. These concerts feel totally different than going to the symphony, and they're supposed to.
You know, there's sort of a considerable amount of baggage with the traditional symphony brand, and, you know, it becomes obvious that the disconnect of what people think of us versus what we are is really extreme.
Richard Lonsdorf is the Associate Director of Artistic Planning at the San Francisco Symphony, and one of the people responsible for making Soundbox happen. It's usually a shared rehearsal space for both the symphony and the opera. But in the opera's off-season, December through April, the symphony didn't have much use for it, so they decided to use it as kind of a musical laboratory.
It didn't really have legs until we could figure out how to make it sound good in there because it's a terrible natural acoustic.
Enter the Meyer Constellation sound system, 28 microphones and 85 speakers that take in the sound of the room, modify it, and then send it back out again in an altered form. It's been called the Photoshop for sound.
So here we are in kind of one of the more resonant settings we have.
I'm standing in the Soundbox room 9 hours before showtime with one of this show's curators, Edwin Outwater. He's showing me how the Meyer system works.
I'm going to clap 3 times. You'll hear the echo that's been created by the sound system. Now we'll turn it off, and you'll hear it without any sound. This is the natural acoustics of the room. Pretty amazing.
It's kind of like the difference between watching a movie with surround sound rather than hearing it through your laptop speaker. There are some pre-programmed settings, like cathedral, as well as specific tweaks you can make to the sound of the room for things like acoustic warmth or reverberation strength. But the Meyer system is only one of the many ways Outwater, as a curator, can and does play with the music in this space. There's also, for example, the visuals.
Imagine you're playing a piece by Vaughan Williams.
Ralph Vaughan Williams, an English composer writing at the turn of the 19th century. This piece features a singer performing a poem against an animated backdrop.
You see an English meadow, you know, around the singer.
In summertime on Breda, the bells they sound so clear.
And the visual cue hits the emotional centers as well as the auditory without explaining what this poem is about, that it's about, you know, people want to get married and the fiance dies prematurely and she goes to the church alone in a coffin. You know, you may not catch that, but somehow it just enhances and people, they start to breathe into the music with these little things.
Music like this can be inaccessible to a younger audience. And for a more traditional symphony audience, modern pieces might be more challenging. Soundbox tries to breathe into the music by programming both, like this genre-bending piece from composer and co-curator of tonight's Soundbox, Mason Bates. Mason Bates is on stage at his laptop, accompanied by a small orchestra. They're performing The Rise of Exotic Computing. It's inspired by the notion that computers can generate their own ideas. Featuring a variety of musical genres allows each piece to shine in a new context. And it also allows musicians to have a moment in the limelight.
I mean, I think I've played almost all of them except for a couple that did not have any percussion or conflicted with major percussion works on stage.
Jake Nisley, the principal percussionist for the San Francisco Symphony, plays xylophone in this piece.
For percussion, especially, it gives us a vehicle to be more than just a color, more than just a part of the texture, but to actually sort of be the melody per se.
You know, a lot of what we're combating is the intimidation of a very dense and historic art form.
That's Richard Lonsdorf again.
Which is, you know, the field of orchestral music for the last, I don't know, 600-700 years. And that can be daunting if you're an uninitiated listener. And so this is really an approach at programming to say, welcome, come on in, you'll get everything you need to know when you arrive.
The Soundbox team is already thinking about next season's offerings, and curator Edwin Outwater would be happy to be back.
There's a sense of joy for me as a creative person in an empty space. There's no sense of tradition because it's a new tradition. I've learned that the audience has infinite capacity for intensity, humor, sadness, you know, deep emotional experiences, and in fact, they're desperately craving those. So the intention to dumb down is always the wrong intention.
And that's the elusive goal, challenging and inspiring audiences while making sure that the music stays accessible and engaging. And to make that work, they'll have to continue to think outside the box. For Cross Currents, I'm Nina Gensler-Debs.
Thanks, Nina. Our winner this week was Melissa Kleinbart, who just so happens to play the violin with the San Francisco Symphony. Congratulations, Melissa. We're going to send you a KALW t-shirt. And there are a few more Soundbox shows left this season. To find out more, head to kalw.org and click Cross Currents. Our team today includes Josiah Luis Alderete, Hanat Baba, Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Nicole Grigg, Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, Greer McVeigh, Lisa Morehouse, James Rollins, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Andrew Stelzer. The show today was engineered by Ted Muldoon. The line producer was Liza Veal. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our news director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. We're listening to the Minsky Duo play their signature Russian chamber music. The Minsky Duo is pianist Monica Chu and violinist Nathaniel Bartley, although he usually goes by Nato. They'll play a free show Sunday afternoon at the Piedmont Piano Company in Oakland. Starts at 4 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Julie Kane.